On the phone with us now is Michael O'Hanlon. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Michael, are you there?
Yes, I am, Leanne. Nice to be with you.
Michael, what's your first reaction to this?
Well, obviously, it's extremely good news. And this is not just because we've all come to view Saddam as our number one nemesis over the years, but because he is an important factor in the Iraqi resistance. And we don't know how important, and it's doubtful that he was planning too many detailed attacks from this spider hole, for example. But nonetheless, he was an important motivating influence for his fellow Baathists. And also, he made Iraqis in general nervous about the future of their country and whether he'd come back to power. So I think for both those reasons, he was important in the resistance, and taking him out of the picture will make a big, big difference. It may not be dramatic right away, but it's certainly in the realm of a very important day, even if not a decisive one.
So indeed, while Saddam Hussein didn't have a direct role in the insurgency, he was providing what you would call symbolic leadership?
Yes, symbolic leadership. He may even have had some slight role organizationally and operationally, and for example, helping his various sub-commanders to come together and begin to develop some kind of broad national strategy, which appears to have developed in the last few weeks as they've been doing more things in places like Nasiriyah, where they attacked the Italians, and up in Mosul, which had been relatively quiet up north. And there's some sense of a national organization. Saddam as a figurehead for that may have made it easier to coordinate, may have made more of a clear chain of command. Even if he was not in any kind of detailed way planning these attacks, it's still entirely possible that his presence allowed the structure to fall into place for the rest of the operation. So there may even be an operational significance to this, but there certainly is a psychological and motivational significance for the Baathists who followed him during his years in power and for the general Iraqi population.
Now, elaborate just a bit what effect his custody is going to have, and in fact, if he's able to provide some information to American forces.
Yeah, this could be a very good opportunity, both in terms of information, as you suggest, Leanne, because, of course, there are a number of other Iraqis out there. About 13 or 14 people from the original deck of 55 cards are still free and unaccounted for. And so we'd like to figure out where they may be. That's a big part of it. Also, there's a second tier of Baathist leaders who have been very important in recent months, even as this first tier has largely been taken out of the picture. And then finally, we have the opportunity, perhaps, to start thinking about some kind of plea bargain. And by this, I don't mean turning Saddam loose after a short sentence in jail, of course. What I mean is essentially saying to Saddam, if you call off the resistance publicly and emphatically and repeatedly, we will, for example, not consider capital punishment, or we will make sure that your prison accommodations are perhaps slightly more comfortable than they would have been otherwise. Not that we would have tortured him or in other ways abused him, but we can make life a little more comfortable for him. And frankly, the stakes here are high enough that I think we should be willing to consider with an open mind these sorts of opportunities. He has to be kept in jail for the rest of his life. I think there's no doubt about that. But there may be some room for maneuver here that could actually lead him, as has been the case with other top guerrilla and terrorist leaders in the past, to actually call off the resistance as much as they can once they're captured.
Michael, were you surprised at all at the rather simplicity, the simplicity of this particular capture? I mean, we are, you know, hearing stories of plastic surgery, doubles, and so forth. Did the circumstances surprise you?
I'd say no. What surprised me was that it took this long. And if it took this long to get him, that meant that he was doing some things that were extremely clever or a very low-key and low-scale in nature, traveling with a very small entourage, as appears to have been the case here with just two other people at issue and arrested with him. So I don't think I was that surprised. It all depended, obviously, on a very good intelligence tip, and we've been working extremely hard for months to try to develop those. When I was in Tikrit being briefed by General Odierno in September, this was very much on his mind then, and clearly it's the sort of thing we've been waiting for that one lucky break for a long time, and several times we thought we were close. So again, if he had had a big entourage, if he had had some elaborate force protecting him, if he had been in some very well-constructed sort of underground infrastructure, we probably would have found him already. And the fact that we didn't meant that he probably was more or less disguising himself as a goat herder. That's the sort of joke we heard in Tikrit when we were there in September with this delegation, that he was probably just melting into the population. And therefore, these circumstances are consistent with what the 4th Infantry Division was expecting.
I'm going to put that same question to NPR's Eric Westervelt, who is in the studio with us. What do you think, Eric? Did it surprise you, the simplicity of this particular operation?
It did in some ways. I mean, it was a cordon in search, as the military calls it, where they encircle the area and then go in. It was both regular troops and special forces. And, you know, as Michael's pointed out, he didn't put up any resistance. And I think that does highlight the fact that, you know, if he was playing a role in the resistance organized throughout the country, it was probably limited because, it made him more of a target and gave away his position if he was meeting with commanders regularly. I think details will come out about that in coming days, but it appears initially that his contact was probably pretty limited.
Michael O'Hanlon brought up the possibility of some plea bargaining for information. What about that, Eric? And what about also the prospect, perhaps, of a trial?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we'll see if there is some, you know, room for maneuvering, as Michael pointed out, in terms of getting information out of him. I know the White House and certainly top military officials have talked in the past saying, you know, we don't, you know, negotiate with people like this. But clearly, because the resistance has been so heavy and we've seen a spike in attacks and an increase throughout October and November from suicide bombings, to the roadside explosions, they may try to do that, and we'll see. But I think it's unlikely that that will happen quickly.
Just to recap, Saddam Hussein has indeed been captured by U.S.-led coalition forces just outside his hometown of Tikrit. Michael O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institution is on the phone with us. Michael, I want to ask you just a little bit perhaps about U.S. foreign policy. How much actually do you think foreign policy was actually concentrating on Saddam Hussein, or had he become almost a secondary factor?
I actually think he became a larger factor as the months went on, because back in the summertime, at least I was guilty, and I think many others were, of thinking that he was a pretty minor player in the whole scheme of things in Iraq, and that his capture would certainly be nice and make us feel better and be an important symbol of the completion of our overthrow of his regime, but otherwise perhaps not be all that relevant to the real task at hand in Iraq, which was building a stable new government and helping the economy recover. At one level, that's still true, but I have to admit I've revised my thinking, because it does appear that the fear that Saddam's continued presence in Iraq and engendered among his fellow citizens, the fear that he might come back to power, and the way in which he could motivate his followers seems to have helped this resistance intensify in the last few months. And most importantly of all, it held out the possibility that the general Iraqi population would perhaps change sides and actually support the Ba'athists, or at least sympathize with them, out of a frustration with the nature of the occupation and out of a fear that Saddam might come back to power, might be successful in driving U.S. forces out. Better to be on his side than our side in the long term if you were concerned about your own neck. So I have to admit that over time, I really came to believe that his presence was quite important. Again, it doesn't mean this is a decisive day, but this is a very important day, and I think it will make a measurable impact on the resistance in the short term and also reduce the chances of a snowballing mass movement in the coming months, which is really our number one fear, as that CIA memo that was leaked a few weeks ago underscored.
Michael, remind us, what resistance actually remains? Who are they?
Well, General Abizaid, as you know, the head of CENTCOM, has estimated there are about 5,000 dedicated resistance fighters that he's been facing in recent weeks. And that's after we'd already arrested or killed 5,000 to 8,000 in the previous 6 months. They're mostly former Saddam loyalists. They're mostly Ba'athists. No one knows for sure how many of those fighters are foreign jihadists and how many of those, you know, people coming in from other countries, al-Qaeda or other operatives. And no one knows for sure how many of sort of the general Iraqi population who were not part of the Ba'athist party have nonetheless decided to fight with the Ba'athists in the resistance. But the general working assumption, based on prisoner interviews and who we're arresting and who, what their identity papers tell about them, the general working assumption has been the vast majority of these 5,000, or whatever number it is, have been former Saddam loyalists. And therefore, you would expect that Saddam's departure from the scene could have an impact on them, and certainly, again, a general impact on the general population, reducing the odds that the broader Iraqi citizenry will take up arms against us.
Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Michael, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome, Leanne.